joy, talks about this. So the Buddhist teaching does point to a very profound, open-hearted experience of non-attachment. But the hardest one probably is what we call upekkha, or equanimity. And upekkha, or equanimity, the fourth of the what we call the Brahma-viharas, or the divine abidings, is not coldness. You know, this is equanimity sounds very cold, but the others are there. So what is like equanimity when I see my mom's pain? What is equanimity there? Does that mean that I say, I laugh? No. Does that mean I don't experience it? It's not worry, but it's actually being fully with the feeling of pain, but not creating more around it. That's equanimity. So it's an open-hearted acceptance of the way things are, and you have to trust in that. It does work. So I always say, you know, it does work. Open-hearted acceptance, you let it into your heart, and the mind has peace because you've let it into your heart. Resisting it cannot lead to peace, because then there's always that resistance, because there's always that possibility. And so in those, in our lives, in those ongoing close relationships that we have with life, which are so beautiful but can be painful, there is a great chance for understanding something very fundamental about the heart. You go very deep in the heart. And then those lessons are powerful for all the other relationships that we have.
If you're unfamiliar with the scriptural basis of the particular school that we operate under, just a brief introduction that I was trained in Thailand, and initially, afterwards I was in England, but in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, Laos is a kind of communist Buddhism now, it's having a lot of political problems. Cambodia pretty much got knocked out with Pol Pot. But those countries would be the Theravada countries, right? So you have Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka. And Theravada is the school of the elders. Thera means elders. And Theravada Buddhism came from India in Sri Lanka 250 years ago, plus or minus a few weeks. So it's the school of the elders. It's got one of the oldest bases of scriptures. Buddhism, so I think to understand all the different forms of Buddhism, you have to understand that they're kind of cultural flowerings. So Tibetan Buddhism, Zen, Chan, Pure Land, all these different schools that exist are the different ways that cultures evolved and Buddhism evolved through those cultures. So that the scriptural basis of Theravada Buddhism is called the Pali Canon. And in the Pali Canon you have the suttas, the Vinaya, and the Abhidhamma. And the suttas are the discourses, the Vinaya is the rule of discipline that the monastics keep, and the Abhidhamma would be the kind of higher philosophy, maybe. So in the suttas, you have various books in the suttas, and one of the books is called the Majjhima Nikaya, and it's the collection of middle-length discourses. Right? So that's what this is. And what is really rather marvelous right now in Buddhism is that in all the traditions, a lot of the original texts are being translated, but translated now, I think, like this rendering would be probably a fourth generation English translation. So the original translations of the Pali Canon began in Sri Lanka by Indologists, people working for the Raj, British, who were interested in I think Sri Lankan civil service and Sri Lankan governance. And they were Pali scholars, and they're translating these texts, and they came across Buddhism. So those were the early texts, but a lot of the early translators were Christian, and they had no real sense of a non-theistic religion. So their translations were good in the sense that that kind of original work was quite marvelous, but it lacked a lot of insight. And then you have scholars, and now what you're getting is both scholars, meditators, contemplatives doing the translations. They're getting some pretty accurate or very interesting translations. Having said that, usually these texts are rather difficult for people to get into, and many people prefer to hear a contemporary teacher talk about Buddhism and get it more from a more in the language of the present day, more kind of colloquial language. So just that's so you get a bit of a feeling where we're coming from. Which is the best school? Well, obviously, it's the school that works for you. Right? So rather than get into, my football team's better than your football team, it really, I think the litmus test is, does it work for you? Does it for your heart? What about like mixing traditions? Fine, but one has to be careful not to get a kind of mishmash of languages and concepts, because sometimes words that are used in the Pali, you might get the same word being used in Tibetan tradition, but it comes from a different context. So you really kind of have to understand the context of the language. Like say in Tibetan Buddhism, there's the use of the anthropomorphizing of mind states. So like Tara, they have all kinds of deities to represent mind states. Wrathful deities, loving deities. But Theravada doesn't have that. So you have these two beings on either side of the Buddha, right? Let's say if that's Kuan Yin. In Theravada Buddhism, you don't have Kuan Yin because it historically hadn't evolved, or it hadn't arisen. It arose in China. So you get different symbology, different representations of the teaching and the cultures and the different art forms and so on and so forth. So it's quite a complex subject. Even the word Buddha, they even have a thing called Buddhology, and do a degree in Buddhology, which is the use of the word Buddha over 2,500 years and how that has evolved. Anyway, this is a quite a good sutta. It's the sutta on the removal of distracting thoughts, and it's from this middle-length discourse of the Majjhima. So I thought we'd just kind of plod through it a bit, and maybe just to give you a feeling of actually using a text, if you're interested, as the way of contemplation, and then just also because it's a very good contemplation. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sawati in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika's Park. The suttas and the Vinaya, so that's the discourses and the monastic discipline, were put down in recitation form because in those days they trusted memory more than writing. There was very little writing. So it's more like you have the genealogies in a shamanistic culture, maybe, in an Aboriginal culture of genealogies which are chanted. Well, in the same way, memory, they tended to rely more on memory, on chanting, on recitation for transmitting ideas. So these suttas, history has it, that a monk called the Venerable Ananda had a photographic memory, and he was the Buddha's attendant for the last maybe 25 years of his monastic life, and he knew all the suttas. And so tradition has it that he recited all the Sutta Pitaka, the basket of the suttas, at the first council, which took place after the Parinibbana of the Buddha. So when you hear, thus have I heard, that's Ananda speaking, Venerable Ananda speaking. And then it always names the place where the sutta took place. So there's always a kind of classical introduction. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, Venerable Sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this, Bhikkhus, bhikkhu is a monk? Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to five signs. What are the five? Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign, there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. So that's what he's kind of asking us to do in meditation, isn't it? With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. So when you're reading something like this, you're not just sort of believing. You think, well, what would that mean in my meditation? Quieted internally. So obviously, you know, the kind of rattling on of worry or whatever isn't quieted internally, is it? So you got to reflect on that and get a, you know, it acts like a mirror to what you're doing in your practice. So it's not like a doctrinal position that you take or a belief you take. It's just this mirroring of where you're at and what you're doing, obviously. So that's contemplation. And then in the text, there's always these lovely similes which are used, which are quite graphic and helpful. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. So that's the first way he talks about removing distracted thoughts. So let's say you're sitting here and someone is kind of wheezing beside you and you're trying to watch the breath and they're going and you're getting irritated and you start to think, gosh, maybe I should move to the other side of the room or maybe why don't they be quiet? So your mind starts to move and thinking. And why is it thinking? Because it's averse. Right? But because you're quite with it and you're quite together and you're practicing, poor person, they're having trouble with their breathing. And your heart changes from aversion to compassion. And your heart accepts that and go back to your breath. So that's taking out a large peg with a small peg. You change. Right? Now sometimes we can do that, can't we? Sometimes we just notice something, the mind starts to take a path of unskillfulness, and we say, I'm not going there. I'm just not going there. And that's not repression. So we take an unwholesome state and we replace it with a wholesome state. We take the... But you have to notice this, don't you? It can't just be some kind of reaction. You have to actually notice why, you know, that. So you notice. You know. But you know, the person's just having a hard time. That's when the mind's really quick. And the mind just lets go because that unwholesome state of aversion isn't held on to. But you can see if I keep thinking that way, if I'm sitting here and I keep thinking, you know, why don't they go home? Or, I mean, I only get one chance a month to do this. And God, it's so inconsiderate of them. And the mind just goes on. And what it's doing is feeding aversion, feeding aversion, feeding aversion. And that's thought. So if I don't understand thought, and I'm victimized by my own lack of attention, lack of clarity, then there can be no stillness. Plus, I tend to make that particular mind state more strong in the mind. So noticing thought is important. Learning to think rightly is very important. So that's the first one. If while he is giving attention to some other sign, and by sign here we mean a sound, a sight, a memory, let's say you have a memory of something really nice and you start to just fantasize about it or something like that. That's a sign. So memory, sight, sounds, tastes. If, while he is giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should examine the danger in those thoughts. Thus, These thoughts are unwholesome. They are reprehensible. They result in suffering. When he examines the danger in those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. You'll notice there's a lot of repetition. And the reason there's a lot of repetition was that the way that the whole teaching was transmitted was through chanting. And monks and nuns have to memorize quite a lot of chanting. And when you get repetition, that's really nice. First of all, vocally it's nice. You just kind of do that one again, you do that one again. So it's quite energizing. Plus it gives you structures in which to memorize things. So you get a lot of repetitions. So when people read these, because we're sort of used to speed reading, we often don't give it the time it needs. Because to actually study this, you have to have some samadhi. It's not like reading the newspaper. You know, I just read the headlines and I'm done. My mother says, oh, that's impressive. But what's to read? It's the same stuff, right? So, but this is much more. So actually, if you, and usually this kind of reading, you have to have the kind of spaciousness of the mind to settle into it and let it come into you, as it were. So if you want to do a bit of study, don't rush over the repetitions. And read them and let them come into your heart, into your mind, because that slowing down of the mind and in the reading is a kind of concentration. And you look at how you tend to kind of get through. You know, like we read for the punchline, don't we? There's no punchline. getting to the next thing. So in this, it's a different kind of reading. It's a contemplative reading. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. Here's the simile then. Just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or her neck. Yuck. So that, so then you imagine that. You imagine this kind of dead Alsatian hanging out your neck and there for 2 days. You know, that really stinks. That's awful. So too, when a bhikkhu examines the danger in those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. And we've all done that too, haven't we? You know, your mind starts to think really kind of petty thoughts about, you're jealous because, your neighbor has a better snowblower or something like that. or something really pettier, and you think, do I really want to be like that? Do I want to live my life in this kind of Mickey Mouse narrow-mindedness? And you say, no, that's like a rotten Alsatian hanging on my neck. And now that's not repression either. It's just, it's saying, no, I'm not going there because I've been there 100 times and it's suffering. It's too much suffering. But you have to be awake to it. You have to be aware of it. And so it's like one is still practicing acceptance. I accept that there's this unskillful tendency, but I'm not practicing complacency. I'm saying, okay, that's the way it is, but I don't want to be reborn into that realm, thank you. And you don't go there. You stop thinking that way. And it's not repression, it's just a kind of logical conclusion. Right? So sometimes that works, but not always. So then, if while he is examining the danger in those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. When he tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. So with the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally. You get these kind of refrains which kind of remind you. Steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Now, I doubt if the Buddha said that like that every time. I mean, that would be a bit absurd, wouldn't it? Because life isn't that way. So obviously what happened with the memorizing community that was taking these things in and then transmitting, they got stock phrases. They got these stock phrases and they learned them. And then that's the way they transmit it, because you need stock phrases. But then those stock phrases, if you just kind of gloss over them, I read that already. I've been there, okay, what's the next one? You kind of miss that impact on the heart, that impact to But take this in now. Take it in a lot of times, and then that begins to echo in your ordinary life. At least that's how I operate with it. So with the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally. Okay. So the simile then, just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that had come within range of sight would either shut his eyes or look away, so too when a bhikkhu tries to forget those thoughts and does not give attention to them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Now that's the refusal to think those thoughts. Now that again, I think there's a kind of, for me, there's a fear of repression in our society, which is probably justified, okay? So if I'm forcing myself not to think, then there's going to be violence in the mind, right? I'm not going to think, oh, there's that thought, fear, conflict. But if I notice I've suffered a lot from cynicism. I often talk about that. So my mind, just through a lack of awareness and skillfulness over the years, developed this ability to be marginally clever, but maximally joyless by being cynical. So I could just, I could make comments about things and so on. But then I discovered that had just become the way the mind just kind of fell into it, just plunked into it. Plunk, I'm in there again. I just found myself into it. So I had to make quite clear determinations in my mind. No, don't think like that. Because I understood where it was coming from. I had analyzed that. It wasn't some kind of big emotional trauma which I had to cathart. I had to let forth into my heart. It was no big deal. It was just bad habit. Just bad habit. Maybe the roots of it, wherever the roots were, but I had seen that, said, no, you just got to train the mind not to think that way. And that's what happens with the mind. It's just sort of, it's like, if you open that attachment, that's where your mind will go. So the mind starts to think cynical, I'm not going to open that attachment. These little attachments, I've got an upgraded computer. Now, I used to be in this position where I couldn't get my attachments open. Now I can get my attachments open. I'm wondering if it's really worth it. but that's what happens. If I'm not aware, then that movement towards, say, cynicism, just becomes automatic. And then I just find it's like gravity or like a momentum just goes that way. I say no, and that's training the mind. It's not repression, because it's not from violence. It's from mindfulness. It's from care. It's from love of this being. It has to come from the right place. Now, if there is a really strong emotion coming forth, let's say I've been shocked by something, someone is sick in the family or robbery or something, really shocked by something, then by knowing these emotions in the body and not taking the thought, I can still process things. I'm not repressing things. So like yesterday, I got a phone call from New Zealand. A friend of the monastery's committed suicide. She hung herself. I knew her really well. I've done lots of retreats with me, and she helped build the monastery. She's a carpenter and a carver. And she got, whatever the story is, she hung herself. I was talking to another friend. And that's awful. That's an awful, image in the mind. So that impacts me different than just my cynical habits. So I have to, when I get impacted by life in some way, I have to process that. Have to go, but I don't have to go to thoughts. I thought about it, obviously, but I don't have to go to that skillful, unskillful, like depression, depressing thoughts, or just the habit of unskillfulness. I think, oh gosh, she must have been in really, isn't that sad? Or must have been in really bad shape. So I can feel the compassion and the sorrow, but I don't have to go on some kind of mental trip of depression. I don't have to go there. That's wrong thinking. I have to feel it because I'm a feeling being. I have to register, don't I? And these, you'll have, this is my take on it with the text. Each one of us has our own considerations around it, whatever teachings, you have to consider what these things mean for you. But perhaps I'm also talking about how to consider a teaching, how to contemplate. Right, so, but if, while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. When he gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. I'll go back to that. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Just as a man walking fast might consider, and then this is the simile, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. And then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that was subtler. So too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Yeah, that's kind of difficult. But what it points to is analysis. This is where you'd have analysis of why this particular obsession, say, keeps coming into mind. So it might be like forgiveness quite often. That's a tough one. Maybe you get really cheated by someone or betrayed or these kind of really, let's say you're betrayed in a relationship in a very kind of immoral and nasty way, okay? And you're utterly shocked by that betrayal. Now that's a powerful thing in your mind. And then you find, come welling up with a whole huge emotional volcano, and then two years later you're still obsessing with it. Right? You've kind of gone through the volcano and the mind's still there, and you try everything and just your mind, you just have to go back in. Well, why? What is the feeling there? What you have to analyze, why is it going there? And you see maybe that actually you can't forgive and you want to hurt the person. You want to get back at, you want revenge, you want to really hurt them, and the only way you can hurt them is by, wishing them they drop dead. Or whatever you wish. And you find there's this kind of vengeance in the mind or other, and you discover that, and you see, oh, that's where it's coming from. You say, okay, let's get to that feeling. So you kind of go back and back and back. And that's very much what the modern psychological techniques use, don't they? Kind of get to the root. So typically child abuse, say, those kinds of things are so kind of hidden in the psyche, so covered over that it's hard to actually find out where the fears are coming from or whatever, and one has to go back. And we have different ways of doing that. With the world one, we just talk to each other, we look at it ourselves or whatever. So those are more deep-rooted and more kind of obsessive. Now this is the really strange one. This will get you. Now all this doesn't work. If while he is giving attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then with his teeth clenched, here we go, his teeth clenched, right, and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush his mind with his mind. So you look at this, you say, wow, now that's repression. That's good. This can't work. But what it challenges you to, well, that's what the text says, right? And this is the closest word we have to the master. So we say, I think I'll take up something else. I don't believe it. So it's not asking you to believe it, because you don't want to just believe it. So what might this refer to? Because certainly that could be misused, right? You could just use it like in a kind of repressive way, and then you have some kind of bad result. So, when with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated.
Wow, is that possible?
Could you possibly do that? Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him, right? So too, when with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, a bhikkhu beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind. His mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to stingless, and concentrated. So, I mean, I look at that and think, well, what's this on about? Now, I think you have to do this with a text. You're going to come across stuff where you think, holy mackerel. you're just not going to be able to understand it. So, and I know, then you go seek someone else out. So, I've talked with monks about it. How do you see this? And you go to the commentaries. So, or whatever. As you get a commentary in there. Let's see. So you go to 243, right? You go to 243. And 243 says, take up jogging. So it doesn't give you anything. It says, he should crush the unwholesome state of mind with a wholesome state of mind. Well, how could crushing be wholesome? But anyway, all of that. The way I'm not saying I'm right about this, but the only way I can accept that is that, let's say I'm so angry I want to kill someone. I'm just so angry I want to kill someone. I'm just so angry at the neighbor. I've got to crush that until I can deal with it. I've got to say, you just can't do that. You don't think like that. Just don't think like that. Until I've got enough space maybe to deal with that rage. I mean, that's the only way I can get a hold of that one. I mean, I find it a difficult one. But that would make sense to me. There'd be something. And I wonder, that person that finally let that idea in the mind, I can't take any more. I'm going to kill myself. And what I've read about suicide is there's something about the kind of black dogs of depression that hover on the edges of the mind and then finally take over. And there's a kind of relief in the suicidal mind, I've read, where when that decision is made, there's a kind of a peace that comes about. This pain will be over. Which is frightening, isn't it? Which is really frightening. And I'm not here to judge, another person's pain, but you could see how if one's entertaining something very, very, very unskillful or cruel, one just has to know. Just don't let that in. And then one's still going to have to, I think, deal with the where that's coming from, where that's coming forth from. Now, most of us don't face that kind of extreme of, wanting to kill someone or whatever. But if that did come up, I think that's the way I take that. I mean, you take it how you want to take it. But also just to indicate that you come across things like that, which make you really ponder and question and doubt, which is good. It's Buddhism's not saying you have to believe this. You have to try to integrate it. And if there's some part of the text which doesn't work for you, don't worry about it. Take what works for you. Ask or whatever. So then the text just goes through those five again. Anyway, so thought is important. But Buddhism doesn't talk about no thought, it talks about right thought. And that's important. That right thought. The thoughts of wholesome thoughts, thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of aspiration, thoughts of skillful responsibility, thoughts of planning, these are fine. But unskillful, unwholesome states of thoughts which are driven by greed, hatred, delusion will lead to more greed, hatred, and delusion. And we have to see the difference between the feeling of aversion and the thinking and perpetuation of aversion through thought, as an example. It's phrased in many ways. One of the ways is the realization of the deathless. So there's a profound switch in the mind in that realization to realize that the heart has to be free from becoming. So the whole tendency of to move to the future or cast back to the past, this whole creation of an ego self, the distractedness of sense consciousness, the aversions and fears and all of that, they are what we call the five khandhas, the five aggregates, or the way the mind body moves, and we get distracted by it. So our attention is always sort of into thoughts and sounds and sights and trying to do something about it. Get some experience, get happy, get rid of it, thinking. And so when attention is always like distracted like that, there's no opportunity for revelation, something new to push the mind. So what we're doing is by training in the breath and so on, we're creating the foundation for enlightenment, but then it just has to happen. And because we talk so much about it, that you get greedy and try to get it. So it's a kind of... Now, there's an aspiration, there's a spiritual aspiration that we have, a kind of... which is a kind of fire in Buddhism. But it can't be done through the usual way of becoming something in time. It has to be done through an effort which allows the attention to stay very still and notice the way things are. So then all the teachings around anatta and anicca, on change, on impermanence, on not self, are pointing to where it's not at. It's a sort of via negativa more. So the kind of the language of letting go, abandoning, and so on is to bring your mind to that. But I think, I mean, the sense of presence that the Buddha must have had is probably much more profound than the presence I have. But the sense of presence I have now is much more profound than 30 years ago. Right? So there's a kind of deepening of what that could be, that sense of presence and awareness, and a deepening of the heart qualities of love and compassion. And from that, and that's, I think, all you can really do. You know, you develop samadhi and things like that. And the image Ajahn Chah would give would be the famous one of just, if you want to, well, he used mango trees, if you want to have a mango tree, you know, you take the mango, you take the big seed, and you slice into it, and you grow roots in some water, and then you put it in the ground, you put fertilizer on it, put a little fence around it so the geckos or cows don't eat it, and then you water it and take care of it. But you don't go just pulling the fruit falls as it falls, depending. So all the Buddhist tradition is doing, it's like, you get the foundation right, get that right, get the attitudes right, get the morality right, develop concentration and so on, and keep that mind inquiring in a good way, then the depth of the spiritual understanding has a chance to manifest or be seen. So, yeah? So it seems like such a mundane training just to be present, but it does reveal, doesn't it? You know, when I'm present, I see myself maybe how I get, you know, whatever attached to things.
Sitting and just doing a mantra for the entire period. I hadn't done before, but I found I could stay with the mantra for the mantra meditation, and I also just wondered during the day you're driving.
Oh, very skillful. Because you're using thought quite deliberately. You're making a kind of deliberate intention to be present with something, which is much better than just the, you know, the randomness of the kind of, what do you call those games? The pinball games, you know. That's what most thought is, like a pinball game, just one ricochet after another. But when you're making a deliberate decision, it's very skillful. Because then you're training the mind, yeah. Ajahn Sumedho, when he started meditation, he was just obsessed with thought. So he would just sit there, let go, 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 let go. He just sit there, let go. And he had to do something quite coarse because his mind was so untrained. He had good intellect, but the meditative mind, so good. I mean, he doesn't do that now. So his mind doesn't think much at all now. So each of us has probably a time in our life where we use things and gradation, but mantra is very good. And if you can plug in mantra to things, you know, if mantra can be a reminder of attitudes, good attitudes, a presence and all that, then it's like just this hyperlink to peace. You're there. Because it's connected to that. If you use it skillfully, I mean, you can do mantra as, you know, parroting it, and And it's amazing how many things we can do in the mind, can't we? So it does take a... and sometimes you change mantra. Say like TM uses mantra a lot. Like mantra, using thought, using one thought or like a phrase to replace some kind of obsession or storyline. This is pretty obvious, isn't it? And then you can let go of that. So like I said, Ajahn Sumedho, interesting now, he says he doesn't think much. It just doesn't come up. You know, and I told my dad that, you know, that I remember way back we were talking about thought and no thought, and I said, you know, the mind which is free of thought, he said, that's impossible. And certainly when you start, you know, this can't be done. Not that we're trying to get rid of thought either, because thought's quite natural. But sometimes there's a taste of the mind which isn't becoming or getting rid of and struggling and fighting, it's just very much in the pure present. With nature, you get that, don't you? You see, I was up in the canoeing in Georgian Bay there, and the beauty of those, of that expanse of water and the big skies and the eroded islands and all that, it was very still for the mind. Like in Canadian wilderness, I think we touched that sense of awe and wonder, where the mind isn't trying to do anything with Georgian Bay. You know, we're not trying to build anything or analyze the ecological problems of Georgian Bay, or it's just this sense of suchness. And that's one of the words that that apparently the Buddha called himself. He would say the Tathagata, or the such realized, or the such knowing. This is a funny kind of word, Tathagata. But the suchness of the moment before we add something to it, and just the feeling of the breath before we add something, or the sound of whatever sounds are in the room, or the feeling of your hands touching each other. I mean, just that. Just take something very simple like that, just the warmth of your hands, and that suchness. And it's so utterly ordinary that it escapes us, I think. Of course, the suchness of paranoia, the suchness of annoyance, that's a bit more difficult. But they come into the mind too, don't they? You know, if you're paranoid about something, and those we get much more enmeshed in. So if we can learn to realize pure presence, suchness, knowing, acceptance with simple things, at least we have a foundation of doing that when more complicated things come. And so the recommendation in Buddhist practice: take something simple like the breath, work with that. In Thailand, when they do, Thais love to use the word Butto, Butto. Butto is the vocative of Buddha. Buddha is the nominative. So the Thais love to kind of bu on the in-breath, do, bu, do, bu, do, bu. They just use that a lot. And for Thai culture, it's Buddhist country, it has a lot of, it's a strong affirmation. Just that word, Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. And then one great teacher, his name was Ajahn Fun, but not fun in English, it's a Thai word, but it's a nice name. He was a very loving teacher, and he used that a lot, he just used Buddha as just mantra, Buddha as that which knows, awareness, Buddha as wisdom, Buddha as compassion, and he kind of would just use this word a lot, very simple. So, if, say, in your own practice, I think what's important is finding a way of really grounding yourself in the present moment. You know, finding a way to actually touch base, be here now, realize suchness. Because it's hard enough just to practice on your own, isn't it? It's hard enough to make a half hour in a busy day and to just sit on a zafu. I mean, that seems to be extraordinarily difficult for people to get that kind of space and discipline going. But even that sometimes can just become an automatic pilot. One's there, but one isn't really present. You know, the mind just getting muttering on. So ways of actually that it's like making sure you're touching the earth, you know, making sure you are here, making sure you are practicing. And so things like mantras or things that you have to do, but more active than the breath, are very good. So even if you start your meditation practice by standing on your head for 10 minutes, that takes much more presence. You know, to do a difficult yoga posture is a bit more difficult than sitting there with the breath. The breath is more subtle because it's more difficult, in a sense it's more subtle, but doing something very obvious. So mantras or gathas or readings or recitations or memorizing things, say, like as monastics we memorize a lot of the suttas, so that's quite a good thing to do. Like the Buddha's words on loving kindness, if you memorize something like that, get it down in memory and then actually have to recite it to yourself, you get the momentum of that sutta, say, or the intention of it by chanting it, plus you get the necessity